We good?
I'm Francis Levy, co-director of the Philip Tatey Center. Welcome to The Mind of the Collector, which is actually a sequel to a panel we had last year that Al Sachs was at called Sensibility of the Collector. I just have to say that for years I kind of wandered through life, not ever running into anybody I knew. But on this panel tonight, we have one person with whom I had set a kibitzing record at the Greenwich Village Little League, one person who went to my high school, and this is all just because of the Philip Tatey Center, another person whose husband, who I'm a very good friend of right now, used to beat me up when I was a kid, and another person whose band I've just been rejected. You know, I fancy myself a singer, and I wanted to get into his band. No, I'm just joking. The Amygdaloids are the band that played here on Christmas, and I wanted to be in the band. And I had a fantasy about being in the band, and I wasn't rejected, actually. I was encouraged to work on it for a few years. Anyway, before we start tonight, and Leah, I didn't know beforehand, but I'm sure we'll connect after tonight. Before we go on with the panel tonight, I have a few announcements. First of all, there is a table outside, and on this table are objects, right? Eric, there are some of your objects.
Actually, they're right over here.
They're right over there. So what's on the table?
What's on the table is a slideshow presentation of some of my collection and how I've used it in artwork.
There you have it. Okay, so be sure when you go around this corner to look at what's on that table. And these are, Steve, these are basically photographs that you have?
There's snapshots of one of the apartments I rent for a collection.
Okay. Now, before I forget.
Which is open to the public for a price.
Before I forget, this is not a magazine. This is a journal. I call it a magazine because of my upbringing, but I've been brought into these higher precincts of culture. And this is we're very proud of it. But I keep calling it a magazine, and I've been warned before tonight started. This is Philip Tatey's magazine journal. It is a journal. And if you are on our mailing list, you will get the free copy of this. And if you'd like to get a free copy and you're not on our mailing list, just put your name down on the mailing list. Now, up-and-coming events. On June 5th, our poetry series continues with Carol Muskie Duke talking about the poems of Sylvia Plath. And on June 11th, we have Eamon Grennan coming to talk about Yeats's The Tower. On May 31st, we are showing the film, part of our film series, Crazy Love. There was an article in the Times about it, actually, about Ron Pugatch, the man who married the woman whose face he threw lion. And Daphne Merkin will be the moderator of that panel on the 31st. And Ed, on June 26th and 27th, is our last round table of the season. That's with
Philosopher of science, but who's also an ex-ballerina and is going to be essentially having a two-part meeting here. One of them will be a workshop showing the effect of the motor system on the functioning of the brain, and then the next day will be the more partly part of that.
Oh, yes. And on June 2nd, we have the panel on transference. It's a neuroscientific and psychoanalytic approach to the concept of transference. Am I stating that correctly? Also, the show you see on the wall here, Eye of the Beholder, has been curated by Hallie Cohn, who is the curator of the gallery, and she's the lady who walks around with a camera taking pictures at all the events. And it really represents the closest kind of collaboration between neuroscience and art. In other words, what you're seeing are many of these are neuroimages by David Silberzweig, a prominent neuroimager, and other works are artworks influenced by neuroimaging by Suzanne Anker. So we have an artist producing works influenced by neuroimaging, and we have neuroimaging works that are conceived of as artworks. So that about takes care of it. I'm very pleased to present now Leah Dilworth, who will moderate our panel. Dr. Dilworth teaches English at Long Island University's Brooklyn campus. She is the author of Imagining Indians in the Southwest, Persistent Visions of a Primitive Past. This work led her to consider collecting as one mode or representing the native people of representing the native people of the Southwest. Recognizing collecting as a discourse, as a system of making meaning, she continues to teach and write about collecting. She edited the volume of essays, Acts of Possession, Collecting in America, and she has served on the board of directors of City Reliquary since 2005. That's a very, very interesting organization, by the way. You should take a look at their site. Dr. Dilworth will moderate this evening's panel and introduce the other panelists. Thank you, Dr. Dilworth.
Thank you, Francis, and thank you for coming. And thanks to Ellen Fertig, who organized the event. And thank you to the Philoctetes, am I saying that right? Center, for hosting it and having us all. And before I get started, I just wanted to, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to confess that I do not collect anything. I had a passing flirtation with plaid ceramic dinnerware, but I've come to realize that I'm sort of the opposite of a collector, and I think there's probably a phobia word that describes that. But I love other people's collections, other people's scrapbooks, other people's family photo albums, anything. Vacation snapshots, I love it. I get sort of a voyeuristic thrill out of looking at these things and to see how people have arranged and displayed them. I'm also a terrible snoop, so if you ever have me over to your house, lock up your drawers. I've managed to turn this prurient interest into a career asset. As Francis said, I teach English, and I've managed to write and publish about this subject of collecting as a discourse. I'm delighted to be here tonight in such illustrious company, and I can't wait to hear what everyone has to say. So I will introduce our panelists, and you have the little biographical sketch of everybody, I think, but I want to associate the names with the information. To my left is Tyler Volk, Associate Professor of Biology and Science, Professor of Biology and Science Director of the Environmental Studies Program at NYU. Dorothy Twining Globus is across the table from me, and she has worked. She's a collector of many, many different kinds of things, and she has curated exhibitions at the Cooper Hewitt Museum, the Fashion Institute of Technology Museum, and she's currently the curator of exhibitions at the Museum of Art and Design, where, by the way, there's a fabulous exhibit of knitting and lace artwork. It's just
radical
great.
Lace and subversive knitting.
And subversive knitting. Thank you.
Very important title.
Next to Dorothy is Stephen Heller. He's the co-chair of the MFA Designer as Author program at the School of Visual Arts. He has also served as the art director of the New York Times for 33 years. He's working on a number of projects. He's published many, many books about graphic art, and I guess the books themselves are like collections. And what I thought was really interesting is you're currently working on a critical history of the swastika.
I wrote.
Oh, you wrote.
That's
sorry.
Gone.
You're working on.
It's a critical history of branding totalitarian states.
Thank you. Okay. So I hope to hear more about that. And next is Bill Skanga, my friend from the City Reliquary. He is the vice president of collections at the City Reliquary. He's responsible for deciding whose exhibits we show, whose collections we show, and then constructing the exhibits for them. And we've had we have a community collectors window that changes every 4 to 6 weeks, and we've had collections such as dipsticks, pens, Pez containers. What were some of the
flashlights, thermoses?
What's
other good ones?
Bicycle stuff.
Bicycle parts.
Bicycle
yeah.
Parts. Okay. Welcome, Bill. And finally, last but not least, Eric Edelman is a collagist, and found object sculptor living in New York City. He's exhibited widely, and his work is represented in the book The Art of the Miniature and Genius in a Bottle, also a monograph on his work called Eric Edelman, Collages of the Unconscious. And when I was looking around the internet to find out more about you, I learned a new kind of object, the bottle whimsy.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
Maybe we'll speak more about that. So anyway, welcome. And before I turn it over to this discussion, it's really just a round table. There's no script or anything. I thought I would just introduce a few questions that we might discuss in sort of three basic areas. And the first is the motivation for collecting. What drives your collecting? Where does the impulse or urge come from? We can talk about desire, obsession, compulsion. But there's also, you know, curiosity and wonder and a creative urge. You know, is it about creating something that's aesthetically pleasing? The second sort of general area would be how collecting is an epistemological system. How does it work? How does it make meaning? How do we know and learn through collections? What kinds of assumptions are behind that kind of epistemology? And then finally, the third sort of area I thought is might be interesting to talk about, since there are so many collectors here, is the way that collections are contained or organized and displayed. Is collecting always about organizing and containing information and things? Can there be a disorganized or disordered collection? And what do displays and collections tell us about the human relationship to the material world? So these are just some questions and thoughts to consider as we talk. And I thought to get things going, maybe we could just sort of go around the circle and have each of you speak about what your relationship to the topic is, the idea of collecting, your own practices of collecting, what perspective you're bringing to this discussion today. So I'll start here with Eric.
Thank you. Well, I guess the earliest memory that I have of collecting things was picking up spare change from my allowance and going to the Five and Dime. And in those days, long gone, I'm afraid, they had counters where they used to spread the stuff out. And it might be in a bag with a cardboard header, a plastic bag, but it was always sort of free and you could rummage among them and get the best one you wanted. And I remember I formed a peculiar obsession for compasses early on and began collecting them, and they've later become a sort of major part of the collections I use.
And you have some of your objects?
Yes.
There's a compass in there.
Yes, several, as a matter of fact, yes.
My dad was a big collector, slightly problematic. When he passed away, we had to throw away literally tons of stuff. My mother is a collector phobe, not unlike you. So whether or not this is genetic, it's hard to say because I've got some of each side in me. How long have I seriously been collecting? I don't know. You know, I've been an artist and tried to involve it in that, and now I'm just sort of a pure collector, I think. I've been doing the reliquary of displaying other people's collections for about 5 years now. I don't know what else to say.
Thanks.
At this point.
Well, I do competitive collecting. It's a sport. I try to collect more than anybody else and things that people don't collect. So you can see there some mini mannequins. What I end up doing is I collect things and then I study them and then I put them in books. So I've done over 100 books. And the mini mannequin book was great. It went out of print really quick. It's very rare. But I had a photographer live in that area for 4 months photographing everything. And he was a colleague of mine at the New York Times, and I'd see him come in the morning. And what happens is those characters come alive at night, and they really tormented him. But competition is really a great motivation. And that's how it started. I had to collect more than my parents. This is very psychological. Oh, wow. I had to beat them at their own game. But basically, I don't consider myself a collector. I consider myself a documentarian, and I document phenomena. And in order to do that, I spend time in institutions looking at material, researching original material or secondary material. But there's a point at which you can only do so much of that, and then you have to have it. So this book, Branding the Totalitarian State, I've collected, and I buy from Nazis. I buy from Italian fascists and people from the People's Republic of China. And I get material that can't be found anyplace else. The book will be finished by 2008, and then it all goes to the Wolfsonian Institution where there's going to be an archive.
Making room for another collection.
Yeah, underwear. Used. At this point, I haven't decided. I'll take what anybody gives me.
So, Dorothy.
Well, I'm very interested in objects and the stories that they tell, and I'm also interested in how you present the objects. And I, as a child, we traveled around a lot, and I was not really able to accumulate. And since I moved to New York, I've really kind of, the floodgates have opened, and it just, it doesn't stop. And part of it is the joy of finding things, and people say, well, what do you collect? And I collect all kinds of things, and if I see something that looks interesting, I'll start collecting that category. And it's an iterative process, and one thing leads to another, and I have certain pieces that I consider seminal elements in my collection that got me started on a whole other trip. And that's combined with the fact that since college, I've worked in museums. I worked at the Smithsonian as an intern, and I found my path. And I'm really interested in other people's collections and how they sort them and organize them. And I've worked with lots and lots of collectors. When I was at the Cooper Hewitt, I did 188 exhibitions in 20 years, and I ran into a lot of interesting people. It goes on, and it's a lot of fun, and I can't stop. I admit it. And, you know, if people don't like my apartment, they can leave. I don't care. They don't have to look at it. But if you like it, I like to show it off and play with it and talk to you about it. So, but I understand that it's too much for some people.
Tyler?
Okay, so I'm a scientist at NYU. I do environmental science, but I'm also very interested in systems from molecular scale up to social scales and psychological scales and patterns of systems. So I guess tonight what I could probably bring to the party would be some questions about the relationship between, let's say, the collecting, some of the collecting we've been hearing about, and data collection, let's say, of scientists. I was thinking once of a oceanographic voyage, research voyage I was on, and how almost obsessed I was about seeing particular latitude and longitude places in the Atlantic Ocean and what the phosphate profile was going to be, you know, down in that site, and try to put them together into a larger picture. And I wrote a book a few years ago called Meta Patterns. And I'm still very interested in spheres and the way I collect patterns. So I collect, I'll take photos and I'll search architectural archives. And I'm interested in the occurrence of the sphere in different places, for everything from architecture to human symbolism, the Zen Enso, all the way down to parts of the body that are spherical, to eggs of creatures that are spherical, and down into molecular structures that are spherical. So I'm kind of really interested in why the sphere occurs in various different places. And so what's the relationship between that and some of the other collections that we've been hearing about? I can at least add my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay. Does anybody want to pick up on a thread that Tyler mentioned, pattern making, or anything else that we've brought up so far?
Well, I think of my categories of things as sort of building taxonomies of, you know, interrelated things. And people say, well, how many do you have? I really don't care. You know, it keeps growing, and so I have multiple collections, and I add to them as I see pieces that make sense to put into them. But I sort them, and I have a California job lot type case that my husband bought for me early on. which has 48 drawers in it. And so I have things in each of the drawers by different categories. And, of course, that's defined by how they fit. So it's quite shallow, and there's certain limitations. And I have a microscope slide, an old microscope slide one, which is even more challenging to fill, and I haven't actually filled it. And so they're very skinny drawers. And so part of it is the sorting for me. I love sorting, and I can always go down to a finer category of sorting. So
I believe that there are things that shouldn't be collected.
Like underwear?
Underwear I'm making into a bigger thing than it really is. But, no, I mean, for me, there are things that I just won't touch, you know. It's because either it's beneath me or it's above me or it doesn't fit into a category that that is in my head. I mean, you know, there's a little compartment, and I collect what's within that interest area. And sometimes they lead to other things. Sometimes it's like a branching tree. But, for example, I collect these mini mannequins, which I've stopped doing because they're extremely expensive. Thanks to my book, the prices have gone up 800%. So I couldn't buy them even if I wanted to. But I'm thanked by the dealers. So I realized, since I was doing this other thing on fascism and totalitarianism, that there had to be figurines. So I started collecting figurines related to propaganda, which I call three-dimensional posters. So I create these taxonomies as well. But I won't collect certain kinds of these things.
I always say I don't collect Avon bottles.
Yeah,
that's
Avon.
My line.
Or Hummelware.
Oh, Hummel, no, absolutely not.
No Hummel.
Why not?
Hummel is Bush collecting.
Not interested in it.
Hummel is right-wing collecting.
But I do like things that other people don't even think are worth collecting.
Fascist things,
yeah.
Or not?
No, there's fascism, and then there's the American right wing. No, I won't support that, but I will expose the other.
Well, you have to create. You know, you have to create limits on what you actually collect. You know,
sure.
you start collecting something, and it explodes like this. So you say, okay, I'm gonna just go with red things.
Right.
So you limit yourself, or you follow a branch for a little while, which way it goes. But you need that structure.
It's a survival mechanism.
Well, and also price is a limiting factor. I mean, I have hundreds of doorstops which I picked up 25 years ago, and now they're so expensive they're not fun to collect anymore. I like the sort of forgotten, underappreciated categories of things.
Yeah, that is the challenge. I was just in Berlin, and they have something there called nostalgia. You know, nostalgia for the East. And I was in the East, and I followed the path I took when I was there 20 years ago before the wall came down. And, of course, it's changed remarkably. But I started buying up all this crap that came out of the GDR. And it's not for my book because I'm not covering the GDR in there. But someday I know I'm going to use it. So for me, there's a system that's building. I just don't look at it as a strict system. I just figure, okay, this is going to go into these boxes that I have, and someday there's going to be a need to pull it out, and I will profit from it.
So it's about profit. You've got a competitive edge, but it's also about making money, too.
I'm joking. As Bill Maher says, I joke. No, it's not about making money, because I don't make money off of any of my books. But I do...
But your collection is valuable.
The collection is valuable, but I'm giving it away. So, but I will profit from it intellectually because there will be some connection that I can make between the GDR material and something else at some point. And I don't know what it is just yet. I tried to figure it out while I was on the plane and couldn't, so it's just pushed away for now.
But it'll become apparent at the right time.
At the right time.
Yeah, no, I have lots of categories like that that are growing. I picked up a bunch of... little envelopes of old photo corners from scrapbooks. I love scrapbooks anyway. And all of a sudden I realized that I had an unbelievably good collection of photo corners. And so they're all in one box now. I recently isolated the photo corners. And it's a great little collection. And they came in different colors. And there were ones for World War II with red, white, and blue. And heart ones for Valentine's. And I like things that are hand-related and sort of past hobby, sort of pastime hobbies that
have
people don't do anymore.
Them.
Yeah, they all have stories.
I mean, the great thing about collections is I could go into anything there and be a docent. There is a story,
right.
And if you look for the story, you'll find something really fascinating. And, I mean, that's what this book on totalitarianism is it's the stories of why people did what they did and how they did them and what the official motivation and the personal motivations were are fascinating. And I can talk about them for hours and put lots of people to sleep.
So it seems to me similar to what in science probably naturalists do. You know, let's say orchid collectors
right.
Botanists, or even the word collector, probably the first thing that would come to my mind would be Charles Darwin or Wallace, naturalists who are going out and finding all these species. And that doesn't seem too different from what you're describing as these taxonomies.
Sure.
You know, that you've got a certain category and now you're finding examples within that category that maybe have some, then you can expand, you can blow up into, unpack into a larger story.
Have the species.
yeah. So it's really a hierarchical or a nested hierarchy. In these cases, the collections, like all red objects, or stamps, let's say. I mean, you used to collect stamps as a kid and coins and leaves. I mean, it does go back with me to childhood, too, now that you brought up childhood. So it's relatively, I guess I would analyze it thinking of systems, it's relatively confined to one kind of one characteristic, like stamps. And now, within that there could be U.S. stamps or French stamps. But it's relatively, it's only a couple levels in a sense.
Well, but I have what I call the crossovers, so that, say, I have a Globe collection, and I have a big collection of New York City small buildings and memorabilia, and I have a Statue of Liberty sitting on a weighted globe, so you see that they do intersect, and that's another thing. I love the whole three-dimensional intersection of this stuff as well.
Because one of the spheres I found was in, not a physical sphere, but in Plato's Timaeus, where this deity is being described as a sphere, and one of the reasons it's a sphere because there was nothing, because it, since it's spinning, obviously the heavens are spinning, if it were cubical, the corners would be, there'd be vacuum behind them, because this is, it was almost like the current view of the universe in which what's outside our universe, either other universes, but then there's what's outside space-time. It's not that there's more space outside space-time. It's all kind of contained. Plato did have this idea, but it was spherical. And then there was these two great spheres, and one was sameness and one was difference. And I always loved that image of sameness and difference as these two spheres that are turning. This is before you get to the heavenly spheres. These are the spheres of abstraction that imprint themselves on everything. And so something such as leaves of trees, they're all green. They've all got chlorophyll in them. They're all, a lot of them are flat. They're all very similar in some ways, but they're different for the different species. And to me, clearly, that's what's going on in some of your collections, in that sort of collecting almost as a pure cognitive faculty. It's like stripped down to the basic. Desire to see, because there's the sameness in the taxonomy of whatever is being collected, and there's what if they were all identical?
No, not interested.
Not interested. So it's the difference. It's the difference within the sameness that.
Well, and it's
leads to
a lot of times it's the evolution of the design. I have a really early stapler that is completely different from any stapler you see today, and they had this kind of spiral rat tail at the back, and you mounted the staples around it. And it was like, wow, this is really a cool thing. And so then I started collecting staplers, and I have tape dispensers. And actually, I brought this one thing because there was a joke in The New Yorker a couple of years ago with the two little snails looking at the little plastic tape dispenser. And it says... I don't care if it's a tape dispenser. I love her. What's really interesting is that Scotch made a snail-shaped tape dispenser after this cartoon came out. And so those are the kinds of things that I really like.
So what makes you, you start off with something, and then this just expands. It sounds like several of you are describing
that. Well, and you start seeing things. You start seeing a category everywhere.
Right.
I've done this in exhibitions, too. Like the opening show with the Cooper Hewitt, the conceptualizer of the show was this very intense Austrian architect named Hans Hollein, and he decided that we should show ordinary designs, so that we did a whole thing on daily bread. I don't know if anyone saw The Man Transforms back in the 70s. And we had hammers, and so I got to collect. I found all these different hammers. I was looking up all these hammer companies, and Stanley had a great collection. And then he said, and we're going to show stars, because stars are certain shapes, but in fact, real scientific stars are not those shapes. And so we started collecting stars. And a lot of these things, no one wanted them after the show, so guess where they ended up?
But that's it. There are all these things in commercial culture that are ephemeral.
Yeah.
And I started just because I was bored on a plane one trip to Europe collecting vomit bags.
A lot of collectors of those.
No, there are lots of collectors of those. And then from the vomit bags, I went to those bags that are in bathrooms, for sanitary napkins. And I have a ton of them. And they are different designs.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, these are things that don't need design.
Right.
So the phenomena is that designers or printers or somebody is given these things and they put different typefaces on them or they put little drawings on them and they become this story that is told. Why are these things so important that they require this kind of customization? And as Dorothy said, lots of people collect these things because they're the kind of thing that if you're sitting around doing nothing, you pick one up and put it in your pocket, and then you find another one and pick that up.
And then
put
you
it
see
in
them
your
everywhere.
So are you looking for the generalizations then of the design of the vomit bags?
I'm looking
like sub categories.
I'm looking to see how many I can find that are different. Within the same parameters, because the size is always the same, the shape is always the same. The paper may be a little different, but it always has to be, it can't be porous.
Uh-huh.
So eventually I'll look at that file that I've thrown these in and I'll come up with a story and I'll write something about it. I'll quote somebody who designs them. I'll find somebody who produces them and I'll maybe talk about somebody who uses them. And it's a story. It's another way of telling a story.
So then you're building this larger structure around these objects after you're done.
Yeah.
And you're no longer making the discovery. It seems to me like it's almost an act of discovery.
Well, it's the act of discovery, and it's kind of like flirtation. And then I have this, this wonderful revelation. I've fallen in love. We have sex, and then it's over.
And you write the story.
And then I write the story.
So you quit collecting when you write the story?
I quit. Every time I finish a book, I'm through with the collection. And like I have stuff that went to the Cooper Hewitt, and as I say, I'm sending a lot of material to the Wolfsonian, because that collection is amazing for those
right.
of you who don't know it.
It's perfect.
But,
perfect
source. That's the amazing thing about museums, at least these smaller museums, is that they embrace collections because the collections are their stories, and then they are these receptacles for...
It sounds like Picasso is a relationship to the kind of the objects that you paint, the images that you collect.
Exactly.
But we did a show once at the Cooper Hewitt of talking about the whole evolution of the museum, and one of my colleagues decided we were going to do it chronologically by accession number, which was really quite a challenge. But it was very interesting because it also reflected what people were interested in at a given time, and the really early stuff. There used to be an antiquities department at B. Altman's, and they used to give things to the Cooper Hewitt in the very early days. And so you always find out all this interesting trivia that I've amassed in great quantity. I think that there are so many different kinds of stories. I've always wanted to do a show on a single object and talk about it from all the different perspectives, the way it's made, what it says about a culture, where it fits in history, how it changes over time.
The only real problem with all of this is that it takes up space. Mm. Any collector knows that space is a premium. I have an apartment and two houses that have these collections. And, I have to send my kid to college so I can use his room.
But
That's a novel motivation for someone who came to college.
But one of the things we talked about, too, was collecting something changes it entirely. It's a totally different thing once you start collecting it. And, like, I started collecting street cleaner bristles from the street. They fall off of street cleaners. They're scattered all over New York City. You never notice them. They're everywhere. You know, once you see one, once you figure out exactly what it is, you're like, oh, my God, these things are everywhere. And some of them are bent, and some are rusty, and some are long, and some are short. So I think collecting really, like, transforms the object. You know? And whether it's transformed it for me, but then when I share that collection with people, they say, oh, my God, what is this thing? And they never see it, and they come back a couple days later like, God, these things are everywhere.
There are a few more for you, right? Because you start picking them up.
Yeah. But sometimes they look at it and just say, what is this? And they don't care at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it is commonplace stuff. So it's transformation of the commonplace, or it's just the commonplace remaining common, and you have a lot of them.
No, you transform it from the common. I think you transform it by collecting it. Yes.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. But I also believe, as I said earlier, you know, Hummel is a bad example because it's just meant to be collected.
Right.
But there are things, you know, there are hangers that a friend of mine collects, and I just don't want to look at his damn hangers. You know, it's not, it hasn't transformed.
Well, that's just you.
No, it is, it is.
Does this have to do with cognition? I mean, it's a line, it's called, it's attached with cognitive faculty of the mind.
What do you mean?
Looking, because what you're saying is there's something that you hadn't noticed before, and also by collecting it and taking notice of it, this is some faculty of human. The human mind that's being cultivated by collecting.
Well, yeah, but and I think you see things differently by the more you know about them. You know, like, you know, bicycles, I started collecting bicycles, and, you know, I'm looking at every bike I see in the street, and I can, you know, I can tell kind of who owns the bike, or if it's a work bike, or the kind of person by the bike. You know, it's all transformed by, but yeah, so, you know, the way my mind works when I see something. Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And, collecting does... The context from which objects have sort of lives, social lives, I guess, they move from place to place, and the moving into a collection does transform the meaning, and the juxtaposition of it with other objects, also there's meaning sort of generated in those juxtapositions, and so it's all about how you organize it and what patterns you see.
Organize it and display it.
And then, you know, what narrative does it tell? So... I don't know.
It's funny that, you know, there's art criticism, there's design criticism, there's film criticism, there's no real collection criticism. And collection criticism, you know, creating a collection, you create a works of art from them, but the collection itself becomes this expressive medium that
yes, it does.
Sometimes gets displayed, sometimes doesn't, but I could see, you know, now in the world of blogs, I could see collection critics going into people's homes and doing these things and starting a whole new discipline, a whole new graduate program.
Yeah, but we're
in a way, the blogs themselves are like a meta collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're busy collecting happenings, things overheard, mm-hmm. things seen, and when they become about collections, there's another level yet.
But they're not objects. To me, it's got to be.
It's got to be solid
that's
and palpable.
You and I are.
We're stuff
we're
people.
Aging baby boomers. From my son's age, they are objects. Or what? We don't. Yeah. They're not objects. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be an object.
Oh no, anymore. I know that, but it's.
Well, that's what I was trying to say earlier when about epistemology. That collection is it underlies the. It's the mode by which we know so many things. I mean, science is collecting was the one of the major modes of or scientific. Practice, right? I mean, that was how you understood the world was by getting a lot of stuff together
well, and you can
looking
see
at
how
it,
how the perception
and organizing
called,
it.
Yeah, looking at different stars out there, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Observation,
stars.
It's
yeah.
very visual. Too.
Bird watching.
That's right. Like, that's yeah, the primal kind of. That
yeah, I mean, or birders that want to get the checklist mm-hmm. off of how many. Of the 6,000 species right. of birds
life
they've
list
seen,
and
life yeah. list.
And I have a friend who's a bird watching cheater. He checks off the list, even if
oh,
he
that's really
but,
sad.
But, you know, another...
very sad.
I'm very interested in museums and how museums present collections. And I finally got to one of the most amazing collections of all time, which is the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. And I don't know how many of you know, but it's like, wow, this was from a time when people... thought they could collect one of everything. And it is an extraordinary collection because they also did lots of cross-referencing. So they, instead of doing it by geography, there's a whole case of ivory. And it's ivory from all over the world, or amulets and talismans. And so I went through this museum, which is dense even by my standards, and it was fantastic to look at these different categories. And it really was about the associative stuff instead of doing it in a more anthropological way. It's a really spectacular, and they've left it the way it was in the late 19th century.
Yeah, but that stuff changes too. You know, that was at the time, that was a very scientific method of displaying.
Right. No, absolutely. And the British Museum a couple of years ago opened their Enlightenment galleries, which is a staggering installation because it's all done using the seminal collections that were the basis of information. So that there's Lord Hamilton's fossil collection, for example, and that was the collection that helped establish what a fossil was, because they thought it was something else before. And so they have put this huge gallery. It's the old library part of the British Museum, and they've done it in a sort of mid-19th century installation. And again, it's this cross-referencing stuff, religions of all the world, and, you know, instead of just one part of the world and all the parts of it. And I recommend it to anyone. I mean, I just flipped out when I saw that. And huge and endless, and you could go back to it forever. But it was about the ordering of knowledge at a certain point in time, and it's amazing to see that they would make the effort to go back to a particular period of time and reconstruct it like that. So it's an exhibit of a time. Fantastic.
Well, Leanne, one of your questions, I don't think you brought it up initially when you were going down your list, but you said something about, does nature collect? What were your thoughts there?
Well, I know we had a talk given about the bower bird at the reliquary a while ago. And I know that animals do something that looks like collecting. But I've always thought of collecting as this really, as a cultural activity, that it's really a human, it's something that's like quintessentially cultural. But then I am thinking that maybe I'm working with am I making an opposition between culture and nature that's not correct? I mean, is there some other way to think about collecting as occurring, you know, across species, across matter? You know, maybe I should just get rid of the divide between culture and nature. So I don't know. I mean, I was wondering what you thought about that.
I think there's some profound difference, but nature does occur in these nested hierarchies, or these holarchies just the biological classification. It's even though it's a human's imposing species, genus, and family, and order, and class. I mean, they're imposing the actual names. Those are real things. I mean, the birds are birds because they have common characteristics, and now there's subcategories of birds. But it really does exist. Mm-hmm. And so the collecting, because I'm really thinking as we're talking that there is something almost universal about this this cognitive desire to discover the more objects within that category, and then putting them together into some kind of new narrative that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. That's clearly cultural. I mean, that's really cognitive. But it could be, you could argue that it evolved because it mirrors the way nature is in these nestings of category. And of course, it would be universal cognitive capabilities would evolve because they are correctly seeing the world as the world is. So that would be, we have a predisposition to think this way in these layers of nested similarity with differences within them, because that works, because it's very useful. It gives us information about the way the natural world is. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the human world, water pitchers or glasses or pencils or hangers, or, the color red, have these categories because now we are projecting out, we are manifesting these basic structures that we originally got from nature in the cultural world. Mm-hmm. So I think there must be some deep relationship, even though nature doesn't collect per se in the same kind of way.
You know, when you talk about nesting, I'm thinking of that movie, A Beautiful Mind.
Uh-huh.
And there's that scene where, what's his name, the physicist?
Nash.
He's in that little room, that garage, and the door is opened, and there's all this paper,
oh, yeah,
as if he just nested himself. You know, it's like, and I looked at that, and I thought, is this a collection, or is this an obsession? Is a collection an obsession? I mean, where does that kind of thing come from, where ultimately, if you were just to look at it as an exhibit, it would have some properties of a collection.
Uh-huh.
But instead, it's his madness.
Because there's some, I think it was Lord Kelvin, or anyway, in science, somebody historically used a derogatory comment by calling other scientists stamp collectors. Because they were collecting all these things, but not seeing the generalization. And I always thought that was really unfair. I will never call anybody or another scientist a stamp collector,
a stamp collector a scientist.
Because if you don't start with gathering data in a sense, that's really the start. And some scientists are really good at data collections, and other ones are the theoreticians that are going to, figure something out. But Tycho Brahe, who was just classifying laying out the latitudes and longitudes of all the stars, that then Kepler came along and used some of these ideas to figure out that Mars was going in elliptical orbit. So but if Brahe hadn't done that with all the stars to start with, Kepler could have never made the overarching theory. And a lot of times the discoveries in science come because somebody gets out of theory and goes down and looks at the particular, finds the particular that nobody else saw before. That's, in a way, the data people are really driving the new discoveries of science often. The Einsteins that can write the equation and make the prediction of the way light bends are often relatively rare. It's usually the data people that are...
The foundation.
Similarly, the collectors are helping the historians a great deal. Yes.
We sort of came near the subject of the collection as an obsession or a compulsion or, a pathology. It's often described that way. And I wondered if anybody wanted to speak to that. I have a theory that because of all the new drugs that control OCD and depression, that all those great collections, those great hoarders and old guys who are stuffing their houses with newspaper, it's all going to go away. We're not going to have
don't
any
be
more
too
great
sure.
collections.
Yeah, don't be sure.
Okay. Right.
I mean, I actually, there are times, I mentioned in that other room, there are times when I'd wake up on a Sunday morning and I'd feel really anxious, and the anxiety could only be allayed not by taking a drug, but by going to the flea market. And if I don't find anything at the flea market, I'm really depressed. I mean, physically, I could feel it. And it just wasn't satisfying my need to acquire within my area of acquisition. So I think it's clearly an obsession. You just figure out how to deal with it.
But what is it allaying? What is the...
Well, something that's missing, love, hate, food.
So it's a substitute object,
Everything, I believe in life, everything substitutes for something else. It's just this long chain that you can never get rid of. So, going to the gym, for me, takes the place of collecting. I'd rather be collecting, but I'll go to the gym and get healthy.
And there's the economy of desire maybe sets in, like the more you can't have it, the more you want it.
Well, I think that's very true with collecting. That's why people... I don't use eBay, by the way. I'm anti-eBay.
Neither do I.
I never go on eBay. If I ever need something that's specific, I have a friend who will do eBay.
So you totally use eBay.
I'm scared to go on eBay. I did it once for a little while, and it was just too much.
You should be scared.
Because I like to be... I like to find the stuff. It's the finding of it. And I go to the flea market or an antique store, and as I cross the threshold of whatever accumulations I'm about to look into, there's a thrill about it, you know, and the potential is there, and what am I going to find? And
yeah, but there's no difference between eBay and a flea market.
Yes, there is.
Yes, there is. Exactly. You can touch
You sit on your ass and you play with the keys, and
you can pick it up and decide if you want it.
It's like you're thinking that a blog is not collectible. eBay is a flea market. It's right there.
It's changing. You search differently. You find different ways to search.
You get a thrill from searching. You're looking at objects. You're collecting stuff. I think it's the exact same thing.
Now, it is the exact same thing unless you love this process, this tactile process.
You have the same
of going
process,
and picking
form.
Something up that looks really grungy and finding that. What I did once, I found this original edition of a book called Neue Typographie by Jan Tschiekold, and I know how much it costs when it's in the dealer's hands, and it was $5.
You start
trembling. You do tremble. I mean, I might have wet myself. It was so amazing. And you find that,
yeah,
or a friend of mine found a stack of books that I knew the price on in dealers would be $3.50 a piece. He found 10 of them at the Strand. And you can't get the Strand experience on eBay. It just doesn't happen if you're like us.
Well, there's the serendipity of it, that you come across something you didn't know. On eBay, you can zero in on what you want,
But is there a serendipitous aspect? No, because you can do all kinds of crazy searches, and you could find something that's categorized improperly that's...
You could do that, and I agree, for those people who are into it, it's fantastic. But it's kind of like Googling and feeling you've done research. You know, it's like, I'd rather go to the library and find something, and if I don't understand it, I'm not going to have it translated by pressing a button and getting really bad English, but I'm going to find a translator to translate it. You know, it's old-fashioned, and I accept that it's about that. But, you know, collecting is old-fashioned, so in a weird way. So be it. I do other things that are progressive and modern.
I'm not saying you're an old, crazy old collector, man.
It's okay. I wouldn't take it as an insult.
I'm proud of it.
But I'm just getting a little tired of everybody's like, oh, I don't believe in eBay. And I think that it's almost exactly the same
experience. It's not that I don't believe in it.
I just don't want to do it.
I think you can get the exact same thing from me. I think it's just like getting up on Sunday morning. I can get up Sunday morning and go on eBay for a little while. And I can get the same exact experience from it.
This is where the real debate is.
Right.
Forget abortion. This is it. eBay versus non-eBay.
eBay or not.
No, but on eBay you don't meet the characters you meet at the 26th Street garage.
I don't even like meeting them.
I sort of see the regulars and I do
because you meet someone, you email someone, they've got a collection, you know, people are friends because of eBay.
As I say, sometimes I use it, but I try to avoid it because there's enough, you know, it's a control mechanism for me. And
but, you know, I don't do eBay, but I do get these emails from people who are dealers mm-hmm. out there. And I do get, for the Totalitarian Graphics book, I've been dealing with somebody, he calls his firm Dakota Hoff, and he's in South Dakota, and he's a Holocaust denier. And I made it very clear when I started getting information and buying from him that I was a Jew from New York who did believe in the Holocaust. And I've gotten amazing things. And what happens is every week I get an email with a listing of material. And that is a thrill because the stuff he has is choice. I don't know, he must have been Hitler's grandson.
Idaho, did you say?
No, South Dakota.
South Dakota.
You know, a red state. Yeah.
Well, I mean, is there an ethical issue here with collecting?
There
these
can
sort of
be,
objects?
I suppose. I mean, with me, I always question. It took me a long, long time to get to the point where I'd actually buy this material. But since I've justified it by creating a book that will explain all of this once and for all, and that I'm giving it to an institution after it's done, I'm not going to hang it in the apartment and dance around, have rights. I figure, you know, it's going to go someplace where it will have historical significance.
But here's a question for you. During this time that you have the collection in your possession,
do you derive any sort of visceral pleasure from having it there?
Yeah, I do.
You do enjoy it.
I do. I do, yes. I get very excited and I tell people, and once I get the material, I do have that shaky feeling, and, you know, it's like, life is worth living again. But, it's there for a reason. There is a clear-cut reason, and it's not that I'm buying it for the pure aesthetic joy. I'm buying it because I found something that will help support whatever thesis I have.
We had a question from Alex.
I just wondered about your statement about having you kill your collections. Once you're finished, it's over, and you don't go back.
Right.
It is no longer of interest to you. I mean, that's sort of like murder.
Yeah. Well, it's not murder because it's like giving up something for adoption. You know, I haven't killed them. I'm just giving it to somebody else. But, I mean, my interest isn't there because I've done all that I can do, and other people will do more and probably do it, hopefully, with the material that I've acquired. So I see it as just, you know, the circle of life as opposed to murder. But the collector as murderer is interesting. You know, in the movie Seven, the guy who was the pathological killer collected skin, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but these are movies.
Yeah, but they're based on...
There have been real life
the
ones.
Collectors are often demonized in popular culture.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I mean, there's other movies in which the serial killer is a collector.
This could be a good film series for here.
There's an essay in my book about that. Anyway... Maybe we should open it up to the audience for participation.
If you go to the microphone and say who you are,
Wow. I just am interested. My name's Bridget. That's anyway. I was just interested because everyone here has managed to take their what is almost like an obsessive quality and turn into a positive thing, but there are a lot of people who, for whom it's not turned into anything but a kind of almost like an insanity. And so all of you in the panel, it's a positive thing. You've turned it into something that's giving you income and giving you. But what about the kind of aspects of it that are sort of controlling and bordering on insane? And that you started bringing that up anyway. Mm-hmm.
We need a psychologist or a psychiatrist to talk about this.
I think if we had the spouse of the people here, they may have
a perfect example of that. My husband just finished a tatami room, a Japanese empty room, and it's his escape from the rest of the loft.
My wife will never go into that room, and it's right below our apartment.
I draw that line at, like, you know, I see myself getting obsessed, like, oh, man, is this bad? Is this getting bad? And, you know, I've recently sort of drawn the line at, like, you know, hoarding is bad. Hoarding is collecting things for yourself, and there's not sharing, no one's seeing your collection, you're collecting things and putting them in boxes, and I think sort of, I've decided that it's healthy when, you know, you can share it, you can display it, other people can see it, you're doing something with it, like you're doing something with your Nazi stuff that's kind of weird that you collect. You know, I think that's the line of when it becomes healthy.
We recently saw a film on Alan Stone, The Collector, which came out, and the film is more like gluttony, actually. He just collected. It wasn't so much to share with people.
Right.
And there were artists who didn't want to have their work bought by him. He often didn't want to relinquish
his work.
True,
but he also had a gallery.
He did show
a lot of amazing work.
He showed his work, but sometimes he would take on an artist's work and refuse to put it into the marketplace at all and just want to keep it all to himself.
But gluttony is a great word, because I think a lot of this is gluttony.
But he had no epistemological element in what he was doing. It wasn't the search for it. It was just he'd see things. It's not like what you talk about. It's like what Bridget was saying. It's a different variation on that whole thing.
But, you know, any one of us... Right. But I feel there's an element of control. I bought up the market of mini mannequins so that nobody else could have them.
No,
I think, but it's control of a lot of things. I think, quite honestly, you know, if there were different sociological and personal issues, I could easily go over the edge. You know, it's there. It's quite clear. But, you know, I keep it intact because I have this hierarchy of I'm doing, or the structure that I'm doing it for publication, and I write about it and all of this stuff. But if I didn't, if nobody bought the things, I'd still have them and something would bad will happen.
I think it's an interesting question because I sometimes will start going off into fields, let's say something in archaeology. You know, I'll read an article and I'll really want to know more. Oh, I need to know something about linguistics, let's say, you know, when this search for patterns. And sometimes it does take away from me being, you know, focused, you know, and this is my field, and I'm, you know, one of the 10 experts in this field, and the way you get ahead in the university system is by, you know, staying as the kind of the lord of that area, and I'm now spinning off for hours into this that may never, you know, have any fruit. And I can always say that maybe it'll come into a chapter on certain, some kind of pattern, but I do sometimes get a little concerned. I just have to say, okay, I have a job, and I'm fairly okay. So, you know, allow it. But I could see, you know, getting off. I could see it wouldn't be too difficult to really spin off into, you know,
madness.
The brilliant mind type madness, you know, where the walls are pasted with.
But also, something. You know, if you are trying to corner a market on something, for whatever reason, if somebody else comes into your field of vision, I mean, I was joking about competitive, maybe I wasn't, but, you know, you can get into this situation where, and it happens all the time when experts are pitted against other experts in their field. Right. There is something that, you know, whatever it is, the competition, the jealousy, et cetera, can become
very... Look at this fact.
Exactly. And the fun is out. I mean, we haven't talked about fun. You know, we've talked about obsession and we've talked about compulsion, but there is a lot of fun to all of this. And I don't think I'd do it if I didn't get some sort of satisfaction where I could smile. If it was always just gritting my teeth and feeling nervous and shaky, no way. I get enough of that in every other aspect.
Yeah, I agree.
I never feel nervous. I mean, I get shaky if I find something excited, but I love what I'm looking at, and I love putting it together in different ways. For me, exhibition of it is also a big part of it, and how you and that's what I translate into the installations that I work on in all the museums I've worked at, and that's another part of the fun. Coming up with a way to tell a story about objects by the way you arrange them, and the spaces between them are as important as the actual objects, and you can tell all these narratives that are unwritten in just visual narratives.
So we all have this public side of the collection. So I don't know what happens when it's just private. It could be the same.
Maybe it has something to do with, you know, it's okay until the objects. You're controlling the objects, but then if it starts to slide over into the objects controlling you, and in the way that hoarders, I guess it's a sort of recognized pathology of older people to
call your brother problem.
Right, to call your brothers that, you know, their collecting killed them, and you know that it's a hazard that way, and that's when it becomes
I always felt they were
a problem,
kind of not very discriminating
they were hoarding, and were they the ones that were crushed?
Yeah. They buried themselves in their stuff.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Hallie. I just wanted to ask, particularly Eric Edelman, but also Dorothy, about the idea of taking the collection and making art, really making art out of it, and that transformation for you.
Well, for my part, I found myself slightly disagreeing in terms of the motivation for collection. For example, a lot of the stuff that I collect for use in artwork of necessity must be redundant. I have to have a lot of it. Sometimes if I'm trying to create, give an effect in a construction, I need to create a massed effect. And so therefore you'll see in the pictures in the slideshow and a lot of this stuff, it is of identical things and it's not really collected so much for its uniqueness as for another quality that attaches to it. The other thing I wanted to say at this point, I wanted to take the opportunity to address your epistemological idea. I actually think that under you can actually sort of construct a kind of archaeology of epistemology in this way, through the collector. I think it actually first, in my opinion, through a reading interest I have in the art of memory, I think it first originates in Western culture in the method of loci, back with the Greeks.
What?
The method of loci, in which you visualize a well-known place, a palace, and you visualize yourself walking through it, and you place objects that you wish to remember in the given order and sequence in which you walk through the place. And one of the things that became clear to me is that there's sort of a common thread that I never saw before as we're having this discussion between the idea of taking a well-known place, a building or a palace that you're familiar with, and placing all the things you want to remember in each of the different rooms. It's a kind of collection in its own right. And then it goes on, and then you get to the Baconian idea of science in the Enlightenment, in which Bacon actually physically thought that he could see the laws of science emerge when he'd collected enough phenomena together, that all of a sudden everything would fall into the natural slots and the grid works that it all existed in. And so I think that idea persists a lot through through science, but also through culture. It crosses over, I think, more into art when we come across the Wunderkammers, those wonderful collections that the Enlightenment collectors and that wonderful museum you spoke of really were. And I think it continues to there and gets to modern people like Joseph Cornell, who did the same as I in a lot of ways. He and I share a lot of affinities. When I first saw his work, I was really struck by how similar it was to things that I was feeling in my soul. And he collected dozens, tons of the same thing. He might collect little glass bottles, and they would be identical, grosses of them, watch faces, China watch faces, things like that. Mm. So I find that somehow multiplicity is necessary for me. But the thing that particularly strikes me about the way I collect is I collect older things because there's a sort of sense that I can't quite readily understand, a residue of sentiment about them. They were made in an age and at a time when people weren't trying to make absolutely efficient the manufacture of things, to squeeze down to the last fraction of a cent the way you made something. So there was maybe a lot of waste involved. Things weren't made the most efficient way. They weren't made of the most permanent stuff because at that time celluloid was flammable. You could actually sort of set it on fire and throw it away. A celluloid billiard ball actually is a dangerous object when it gets to a certain age. But things like that, they have a sense that attaches to them of maybe leisure or a value for industries that no longer exist, that sort of thing.
But isn't that just nostalgia? That's just a romanticism of old things,
of
right?
Course it is.
Yeah.
Unashamedly so.
Hmm. Oh.
Yeah, you're right.
Yes. I am a romantic in that sense.
Yeah, Larry Kudlow. Isn't sometimes this collection a reflection of your personality, and your collection will change, you know, as you change, so that even though if you might not let it go, you still allow it to be there, even as it erodes, and you go on to new things, and some of the things you keep, isn't it, because it's part of you, even if you're not active with it anymore.
Absolutely.
So, and it's a very big thing. I think everybody collects.
Yes.
You're professionals, or sound like professionals, and some of us.
Well, we may have twisted our obsessions around.
But it's part of who we are, what we are, and it develops.
Yes.
But the collection, you know, if you look at a scrapbook or a photo album or a box of photographs of ourselves,
yes.
It's our memory of ourselves.
Yeah. That's right.
It's the document of ourselves. So in that sense, we are all collectors, because yeah. I'm sure everybody has at least a few snapshots and now digital shots. And, you know, it's what always struck me about the Holocaust is that when people were forced out of their homes and sent to camps, they lost all of that, everything. And other people may have found it in flea markets later if it was preserved, but most of it was destroyed, the really ephemeral stuff.
They could find it in some other forms. You know, that's why I agree with whoever said it so much, that it's not all a physical object, or that there's new physical objects that can remind you of those things. Speaking of personal life, I mean, I have a scrapbook of me as a ball player. The stuff is shredded away because it's so long ago. Every time I've opened it up, it's a shame. Now, there are a lot of good things in it. It's just not there for some of it anymore. Sad, but so I turn it away. I turn it over. That's it. It's gone somewhat. Still there, but...
Well, you still have a memory, and that's part of a collection as well. I once went to Klaus Oldenburg's studio years ago, and he had this huge room, and in it were just drawers and drawers of underground newspapers. I used to be art director of undergrounds in the 60s, and there was a lot of stuff that I had done that I saw, and he just had it there for collages. So he had multiples of these rare items that I had given away because they didn't seem that important to me at the time, but they were my memory bank. And he was just cutting them up. So it was like, you know, he was putting a knife in.
Yeah, I kind of.
My name is Mark Hoge. I have a question for Eric Edelman, because you're a found object sculptor. I was reading in a book of essays by Joseph Brodsky that he said that when he was a young man, he used to find books in dumpsters. And he says in the essay that books find their readers. And he had this idea that it was the object that found him. It was the book. And do you, as a found object sculptor, feel that the objects that you use in your sculptures, that they somehow find you?
Oh, absolutely.
Because we saw a movie not too long ago on the artist Jack Smith, and he would find things in the street or garbage, and he would alter it and collect it. And it was somehow the same sort of sense. And I was wondering, none of you talked about that, but I was just wondering, does any of you, rest of you, share that?
Maybe I shouldn't confess this here, but I actually, my one real act of dumpster diving resulted in the acquisition of a 1920 Funk and Wagnalls dictionary with hundreds of little engravings in it. It was one block from my house, and it was in the middle of January, and there was this wonderful old Funk and Wagnalls dictionary, and I have a feeling that that dictionary did indeed choose me. And there was also that wonderful quote that Cornell used, which was, who knows what one object may tell another? Well, you could almost paraphrase it to say, who knows what one object will tell a collector or an artist?
I don't believe it at all. I think you found that object and you knew what it was because you're interested in those things and you found that object and discovered what it was. And only because you knew something, you knew that was something you wanted. Somebody threw that thing away.
Well, how do you explain when I was about 5 years old seeing one of Joseph Cornell's pink palaces for the first time and not knowing what the hell this thing was, but knowing that it was gorgeous.
Right, right.
And that my parents actually had to physically and bodily drag me away from it.
Right.
Before I would consent to leave.
Do you think the Cornell found you?
In a certain sense, it did. I feel it did.
It found me in a strange
way that I can't convey.
I don't believe it. I think it's totally romantic that an object would find you.
You're using romanticism rather as a blunt.
Yeah, the romanticism is great. I love this line of thought.
I just, it can't.
So you're just talking about it from the other side, though. You find it because you're meant to find it. I mean, I always...
No, you found it because you knew what it was and you knew something about it.
It's materialism versus idealism.
Right. But you also find things because you're lucky. And you do know what they are, or you have a sense of what it might be. But, you know, I'd like to think that things find us. You know, that's so much nicer.
Well, if this is when you were 5 years old, then this is before you were even making conscious decisions about what you were liking and not liking. And,
well,
and
I've talked to my...
You had a deep...
There was something about that immediate thing, you know, this elegant little box with a funny frame around it that was created by masking paint in a sort of, I don't know, French provincial sort of curve. And inside is this little rare engraving of which all the windows have been cut away. It's an engraving of an old building, and it's back with mirror, and there are trees around it all studded with glitter. And I didn't know what the hell it was, but I just knew that it was beautiful, and it was years before I ever came back and identified it.
But if you had said it just the way you did, just that eloquently, the government would have you in an institution studying you right now.
We have another question.
I agree with you, by the way, about Cornell, and it's such a thing that a child could imagine. I mean, you know, it's not for an intellectual to then go about and describe. But I wanted if we could talk a little bit about. I'm sorry, I just had a root canal, so if I drool, forgive me. But I wondered if we could talk a little bit about status and the idea of collecting and status and perhaps greed, because I think we've all been reading a lot about the contemporary and impressionist art auctions lately and the staggering amounts of money that are being spent on Warhols and Rothkos, et cetera. And what do you all think about this? What do you all think about, you know, is this, you know, whether it's Alan Stone who is promoting some of these artists and, you know, you think about what they cost when Alan Stone was buying them and promoting them and what they're selling for now and who's buying and who are these collectors and what's up? What do you all think about it?
But doesn't that go back to robbing tombs? I mean, it's all about...
I don't know. Tell me.
Collecting, you know, has a greed component and... And that's where eBay drives me crazy, because you see the greed right in front of you. You see all those numbers flicking by. I mean, if you're at a flea market, you just go to the guy and say, okay, will you take five? No, I paid blah, blah. And you go through this ritual, and then he takes
the
five.
It's the human interchange.
But I think there, you know, there are a lot of people that deal in it as a business, and the business is fine. You can't condemn everybody, and then there are those who are really trying to make fortunes off of it. But you know, it's life. It means that, you know, what's interesting is a lot of these artists whose work sell for tons of money died poor or don't get that money. It's not theirs. I mean, let's talk about who owns the rights to things. Mm. You know, who owns the rights to the physical manifestations that you're using in your artwork? I mean, there was an engraver who did it, but it was work for hire back then, so that's nobody right. owns it.
And
but
in every any case, so it's often, fallen into the public domain long
right,
since.
And the public domain issue. Every so often, I get a lawyer's letter, I get a letter from Artists' Rights Association or Saga Vaga saying, I've used something in one of my books that's over 50 years old that an estate has claim to. And I know this stuff. I know all commercial art. And I know it from certain periods of time, and there are no copyrights. Mm-hmm. So somebody at an estate is trying to make hay off of their relative or whatever. I don't blame them. You know, I usually ignore the letters, but every so often I'll pay it if I feel like I've done something wrong, if I feel a twinge of guilt.
But I think this art thing is like a collector's game at a really high, you know, it's art dealers and art collectors, and it's just a high-priced collector's game, that's all.
And I have no interest in it. I mean, I don't care about the value of the things. I just am interested in the objects. I don't
have another question over here.
My name is Karen Rood. I don't think I would agree with you that everybody collects. It seems to me by observation that there are some people very drawn to it and some people very not drawn to it. I have a sister who keeps nothing in her apartment. And I'm feeling that pull even as I'm listening to you talk. I'm both fascinated by the richness of what you have made out of your collections and kind of baffled and a little shrinking from it. But it's slightly overwhelming, and I don't mean that in a way to denigrate what you're doing. I'm just, you know, thinking myself. Does it ever feel overwhelming or cluttering in your mind and in your lives to have these
things? Yes.
Not only space-wise, but just mind and thought and focus-wise.
It is all those things. And it also comes down to, will my son do anything with this stuff, or is he just going to put it in a dumpster? And the fact of the matter is, there's, you know, if you go dumpster diving, you'll find these families that just throw it out. And it is cluttering. It's amazingly cluttering. And I've known collectors who have done, you know, big books on their collections who have just deassessed and totally, you know, went to that tatami room in their minds and in their physical beings, because it it takes on this life of its own, and it's kind of like a tsunami. It's a tidal wave of stuff. So what you raise, I had forgotten all about that because I'm in denial, but now I'm not, and I really don't appreciate it.
12-step program for you. Another question?
This is for Steve Heller. I'm William Soger. It surely was a compliment to have Klaus Oldenburg collaging your
yes,
artwork.
Yes, it was.
And I think that many artists have preserved. I think of the Max Ernst collages of marvelous engravings that are, in a way, preserved and elevated by what he did with them.
No, I agree totally. I mean, I joke about the idea of cutting my stuff up, but I would have cut it up as well. And at least it goes through a great artist instead of me. But back to what you said, it really, you know, it's like this cotton in our brains. And therefore, you either don't do it anymore, and something happens when it's like going on a diet. You know, you can go on a diet and it can work somehow. Or you go on a diet and you feel you're deprived. And I think for me, if I stop the collection process with a purpose in mind, I feel deprived. But I hate to think what's going to happen in another 20 years.
Yes. Well, but I figure it's going to go back out into the Great Maw, and you know, someone else will pick it up.
The Smithsonian's going to appreciate it. You sound like you're pretty. Your bases.
Well,
are covered.
Some of it's going places, but some of it's not going places, and it requires also. I mean, one thing about collections is you were talking about taxonomies and systems. It does require cataloging. And I've got lots of graduate students, and people say, why don't you get your graduate students to catalog? Well, I don't want them going in and disrupting the disruption. You know, it's it's hard. You know, if you really want to do it well, you set up a system. And now with the computer, and there are programs now, and we have a program at our school where you just scan the ISBN numbers, and there's a program that puts it on a shelf on your computer screen. So you actually see the cover of the book if the cover of the book was sent to the Library of Congress and they scanned it for the with the ISBN number. It's fascinating. And, you know, there are people I know who have created very systematic collections where everything is digitized and they can access it very well. And, you know, to me, that's a godsend, but I haven't gotten to that point.
We have another question.
My name is Al Moldovan, and I must say that I feel very alien amongst all you profound accumulators, because there's a big difference between being a collector and an accumulator. What you were talking about, the birds accumulating twigs or something, you think that's a collection? Or what was just said about... Anyway, I think the first thing we have to do is define terms. What's a collector and what's an accumulator? I know what I believe in. I know what I've taught my people to believe in. I have formed a society. It's been existing for 30 years of collectors of Judaica. They have very rigid rules about what you do and why you do it. I've never heard any of my people talk about collecting for their own self-interest. We all collect to preserve the history of the Jewish people who were destroyed in the Holocaust, and every piece we find is a piece that has been preserved. So it has a purpose. But what is a collection and what is an accumulation of junk?
One man's collection is another's accumulation. No, but it's true. Some people think that my stuff is all junk and they don't know why I have it. No, I'm just saying. No, but I'm saying it's about perception.
Collection must have a purpose. It must be directed someplace. It must be analyzed, studied, and maintained and carried forward to the next generation. Otherwise, it's accumulation of junk. If you don't know what your collection is going to do or where it's going to go, if you don't have a museum in mind or an institution in mind or a child in mind, you've wasted your time.
Perhaps I have a complimentary question. To what degree do you all, especially the collectors, think that your passion for your collecting is communicable to others? Can you show your wives or spouses or others how much you care about these things, and do they get it, or is it irreducibly yours? I'm thinking of Frank Zappa's famous booger collection.
Well, certain collections are irreducibly somebody else's, I guess. I mean, mine, I feel, are all about a public. You know, there is an audience for the things that I do. I think there's a commonality of interest. And if there wasn't, you know, I'm not interested in collecting that boogers. I'm, you know, it's unless I can make a really good story out of it. But that story then isn't just going to lie in my desk. It's going to go out to the public. So,
but you sort of attach yourself. Like I collect different things, and different people attach themselves to it. Like, you know, I've got a club of bicycle collectors, and you know they can look at my bikes. We look at each other's bikes. We get it. You know, there's a connection there where, you know, they don't really get my ceramic ET collection, those guys. But, you know, my friend that collects ETs does. So it's, you know, it's different for different people they attach themselves to it.
Can we take any other questions? A couple more questions we have time for? Comments?
There was just one thing, I'm looking for knowledge, but there was a movie by Joe Losey called The Collector, and Pinter had written the screenplay, and I don't remember what it was really about. But going back to the obsessional, knowing that Pinter, I saw it, but I don't remember it.
Was it the John Fowles novel, The Collector? Is that what it's based on?
Yes, that was it.
It's about a man who captures a young woman and keeps her, and then kills her, and then... Yeah, about Lord Hamilton, right?
But that was collected. Mm-hmm.
Right.
We were dealing with the subject of obsession, mm-hmm. and pathology.
But nobody mentioned Andy Warhol. He had houses, he bought houses to put all the flea market stuff.
It's true. I used to run into him at flea markets getting the material. Yeah, he was competition, because I used to collect German satiric magazines of the turn of the century for an exhibition I did and later a book, and he used to buy the same things, and I don't know why, because he didn't do anything with them.
Possession,
yeah.
He made those time capsules, of items, and that they were, I don't know if they're all open now, but they were systematically opening them for a while.
Back on the market?
No,
they're still opening them up.
Auction that went on for weeks.
Right. There's a lot of the museum in Pittsburgh, right?
You can do the same as the Heller.
But I think the gentleman in the back was talking about what a collector is and what a collection is. I mean, I think it gets us back to the idea of memory and, you know, what that's a lot of what collecting is doing. And the metaphor of the palace and it's one of the ways we remember. Collection is recollection. And it's deeply cultural. It seems to be deeply human. To do this, and you know that memory. What is the memory? In some cases, it's a public memory. In other cases, it's much more private.
Would you like to come over to the
microphone? Can I just stay for here?
Sure.
I guess I'm just wondering. Walter Benjamin and his thesis on the concept of history mentions that every documentation of culture is also a documentation of barbarianism, and he also writes a lot about collections, but I'm just wondering, at one point you mentioned that, you know, collections are essentially good for history. And these are individual collections, and so they're allowing you to, I think, present both the cultural achievement and the barbarianism in it. But do you find that these are collections that allow, by having personal collections as opposed to, say, you know, country or state who's collecting their cultural artifacts. Are your collections intended to sort of present both sides of the coin? And again, I'm thinking sort of specifically of your present collection.
When I collect, as I said, I tend to write stories. Sometimes they're histories and sometimes they're more anecdotal. But what I'm trying to do is very simple. I'm trying to uncover and expose material, and I have this belief that other people will take that material and do something else with it, whatever it is, so that it will have, you know, once it's collected into something, more people are apt to appreciate and then do further research into it. So for me, it's a very simple process. It starts with a basic interest and fascination and passion, maybe. And I look at it through different lenses, and sometimes I look at it through rose-colored glasses, so I don't see the barbarian. And in the case of this totalitarian material, I'm just fascinated how people are, how ideologies are branded, and like a corporation, and how that branding then filters its way into the public mind, and one embraces it or not, as the case may be. So the documents that I found to support the visual materials are as important to me as the visual materials.
You're sort of like a middleman in a sense, and someone else is going to carry on like this totalitarian. It's very interesting stuff.
Well, I don't feel... I mean, I can take it so far. I'm not smart enough to take it to the next level.
Right, and then somebody else might.
So middleman is...
Perfect. I don't mean that in
a bad way. No, I accept it in a good way.
Yeah.
Right, there's a question here.
Well, it's not so much a question as much as a comment. I've been a collector for 40 years, and the collection I deal with decorative arts and flow blue china, crystal, epergnes, things like that. And it's just beautiful. I mean, the reason I collect it is I think it's lovely, and I don't just display it. I use it if I have company. But the thrill of the beauty, I mean, I belong to the Flow Blue International Collectors Club, and when you go to a store, you might not find one piece of what you're looking for, and then you go into this club and you see a room full of this, and people who belong to this club are literally swooning and fainting and ecstatic, and there's an auction, and you sit there and you watch how people will absolutely die to have this one piece. And it's not because of the ownership so much as they want to enjoy this one piece to complete their dinner collection or whatever. I was helter-skelter. When I collected, I didn't have to have all cups. I just had whatever was pretty. It's just a hodgepodge. But I have to tell you, is listening to all of you, you really do understand the thrill of it, but I'm not sure you understand it in the same way. I mean, I still go to all of these meetings every summer by myself. The family hates it. They will not have any part of it. They're going to throw it all in the garbage when I die, so I have to make sure it goes back to the auction. But, you know, I think that you have to be passionate about it. And if you're passionate about one collection, it's very likely you're going to have a bunch of other collections, which I do.
Thank you. Great. Other comments?
Can we ask Eric Edelman to talk? Is that correct?
Yes.
About the collection you brought?
Oh yeah. Oh yes. Actually, I was going to pass those around for people to look at. If you
would you talk about it? Please?
Yeah, sure. I began collecting first about 30 years ago, and I basically was collecting objects that sort of accorded with my interest then, which were along the idea of making box sculptures, a la Joseph Cornell. Since then, I've sort of branched out and. The things I do incorporate these things, and there are, as I said, pictures on the slideshow of how I've done that. But I'm also interested in taking other collections, such as the written word, writing narratives and stories specifically related to a piece of artwork, and actually incorporating them into that. The motive for collecting these particular ones, well, I don't know that I can really reduce the taste that I had for these things. There were certain objects at the time that just seemed very attractive. Can any one of you say why it was, for example, that your folding hangers suddenly seized you in that way?
I'm interested in design. A lot of what drives me is the design and the evolution of designs, and I think this is a brilliant object, and it was really very interesting. And then I started finding all these other folding hangers, and why was there such a need for folding hangers? And we actually did an exhibition years ago at the Cooper Hewitt on the subject of travel. And the whole history of travel is of interest to me. And then I started collecting other things that were designed for travel. Today you go to the hotel and you've got the hanger and you've got the hair dryer and you don't have to. And you can fly around the world and you can be somewhere else in a couple of hours. And ages ago, if you made 15 miles in a day and you were traveling with all your entourage and you had to bring everything with you. And yes. So this is a little part of that chapter that I never even knew about. And I remember I showed this to my father. He says, oh, yeah, we always had traveling hangers.
And a lot of times for me, it relates back to my memories of childhood and things. And I remember my grandmother would take little trips to the South in the winter, and she would lay out all her little wash and dry kits and her sewing kit. And, you know, I never actually saw folding hangers, but, you know, a lot of my collections link to memories of my childhood, I guess, and of earlier times.
Hmm? Can you demonstrate that, please?
Oh, I didn't. Okay, we looked at it in the other room. Well, this is an amazing. And the guy who sold it to me handed it to me, and people go like this, and they try to figure out what it is, and then what you do is you go like that. And I probably have several dozen different designs for folding hangers, and then I've found plastic versions of earlier ones. I've got a book with some of these collections in it. But you know, I know you don't like hangers.
No,
but
these hangers I like.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. But you know, I have all kinds of folding spoons and it and a fantastic little series of Bakelite clothespins in little colored pigskin kits that come from Mark Cross, you know, and you brought your little tiny clothespins with matching thumbtacks to hang up the string, and it's all in this little silk-lined pigskin kit. And so I found one, and then I have four of them now, and they're just beautiful. But they're from another time, and you know, you needed to bring all that stuff with you. Now you pull that string out of in the bathtub in a hotel room, and you've got your clothesline. But
the people who love this stuff are art directors for movies. And I get a lot of calls from, after a book of mine comes out, from different film prop directors. And, you know, they want to go accurate, although they usually find anachronisms to work with. But.
Any other comments or questions? Well, I think we can bring the evening to a close. Yes. So, thank you so much. Books for sale? I'm sorry, I didn't. Where is it?
Outside.
There's books. Yeah. Books for sale. Excellent. Thank you. Oh my gosh. Thanks.
They get my glasses on. They did their homework. This is the most elegant one.
Among other things. Yes.
Outside, there are books for sale.
Please.
By the participants.
I took my notes on the box.